In any case, we have been talking about the Constitution, how it is interpreted through the lens of the past. Yesterday we spoke more generally about the way in which equality is approached by the court, how the court is trying to, in a way, like I said, play with two hands, balancing the interest on the one hand of people who might be affected by different treatment, while at the same time recognizing that people are not always in exactly the same position. So now we're going to look more specifically at the hot, really hot button topic, and that is the issue of affirmative action, which people fight about it a lot. And you know, this comes up in so many debates. Here at UCT, there's a debate because there's a policy here that says when you apply, you can apply either in the open category, where everybody competes equally, or there's a second category, which is a redress category, in which the race of the students, they self-declare the race, can be taken into account depending on who you are, you get in a way extra points. That is, for me, in a way, the easiest kind of affirmative action. But then you get cases that is more difficult and raises issues about relative disadvantage. So, for example, there's currently a case that is going through the courts in which the regulations of the Department of Correctional Services is being challenged on the basis that in the Western Cape, their targets for redress measures is based on national racial demographics, while in the Western Cape, obviously, the racial demographics is very different. So the question is then, is that acceptable or not? And there's another case that has gone all the way to the Supreme Court of Appeal. I see yesterday Solidarity just filed their opposing papers for the appeal to the Constitutional Court. And that is cases where, dealing with police, where the police refused to fill a post for which the person who applied, Ms. Barnard, was qualified, but because the target wasn't there was an affirmative action target in terms of race. In the police, there were too many white people in a certain category, too few black people, so they just didn't fill the post twice. So there was, in a way, an absolute barrier towards promotion. And the question then is that acceptable? Now, what we're going to do tonight, I'm going to try and tease out some of these questions and try and show you how the Constitutional Court will deal with it. Having said that, I park that on the one side. I want to make a distinction. I want to make a distinction what the law says in terms of the Constitution and also the Employment Equity Act. And that is one thing. That's what I mostly speak about. But people do not always follow the law. So for me, the big difficulties come in really when the limits that are placed on affirmative action are not actually adhered to. And a lot of when I engage in discussions and debates about affirmative action, it's often not about the principle as such. It's about the implementation of the principle, which is often not done in terms of what the Constitution says. So we can talk about that right at the end. Having said that, I want to start with the question, with the principle that was enunciated by the Constitutional Court, taking on what I said last night, but translating it now specifically to the whole question of redress. And the Constitutional Court said, firstly, and somebody yesterday, I can't remember who, said that they prefer the Afrikaans term, rechtstellende actie, to the English term affirmative action, which is borrowed from England, from America. And the Constitutional Court in the Van Heerden case, which was ironically a case about affirmative action brought by a National Party Member of Parliament, who complained that he was being discriminated against because he got, for 5 years after 1994, he got a lower pension contribution from Parliament than people who had not been in Parliament before 1994. In that case, the Constitutional Court said that they don't really like this idea of affirmative action. It sounds very patronizing. We want to affirm poor black person who's not any good or whatever. While they prefer the idea of corrective measures, redress measures, measures that are aimed at addressing the effects of past and ongoing discrimination. So that is the first thing. Now the heart of this question, I think, is what are we trying to achieve? What are we trying to achieve with the redress? What is the outcome that we're trying to achieve? Because remember, I quoted to you Section 9.2 of the Constitution yesterday, and I said there that Section 9.2 said to promote the achievement of equality. Legislative and other measures can be taken to advance the persons or categories of persons who have just be disadvantaged by unfair discrimination in the past. So is that achieved? The question is, what are we trying to achieve? Are we trying to achieve equalities of outcome? Are we trying to achieve equalities of opportunities? Or something else? The Constitutional Court hasn't been very clear about this, I think. If you read academic literature on this, there's a lot of arguments about what is best. Some people say it seems that if you live in more or less social democratic, liberal democratic state, what you're really trying to achieve is equality of outcome. That what the redress is aimed at, it is recognizing that because of the past, because of the lingering effects of the past, people do not have equal opportunities to fulfill their true life potential. So you are trying to address that problem by dealing with two things, dealing with the immediate situation where people just don't have equal opportunities, and trying to deal, secondly, with the way structurally in which the society is organized, which continues to make it difficult for people to have equal opportunities. The critics of that say, that sounds fantastic. Equal opportunities is a good idea because most of us, when we have some sense of fairness, think that yes, given people's different talents and so on, people with more or less the same talents should have the same opportunities to education, the same opportunities to get a job, and so on. But we are not always very good at noticing the lack or the inequality in opportunity between different people and different groups. A few examples are often used. I'll give a few. One is, one can say, well, there must be equal opportunity for people in terms of education. And obviously, we look around us, we see there is not really equal opportunities in terms of education, because if you go to what schools, shall I be, Bishops or Westerford, you're going to get a much better education there than, say, at the Lusiki City High School. It's just the way it is. And redress measures must try and grapple with that. People are. But other people say, well, it is about more than that, actually. It's even when people go to bishops or they go to, Karl Maritz Worshpool, that I used to go to in Peter Maritzburg. And the problem is, the one school and the alumni of that school, they are in all the important positions. They make decisions about who to hire, who to give scholarships to. The poor alumni of Karat Maritz High School didn't really make it very far in life. And so the two schools might have equal sort of amenities, but the human capital of the graduates of the one school is much more than others. And anybody else who goes to that school have a leg up in the world. It's a kind of reverse affirmative action, in a way. That some privilege is difficult to see, really, we say. That it's not always easy to see where the privilege comes from. The other argument, and that is for people, some of us who are white, that is not so easy to acknowledge, I think. There's an argument about the privilege that comes because of the status that you have as a white person in society. That assumes that you are actually competent, that assumes that you are actually somebody who is not going to steal the milk from the fridge. You know, there are so many stereotypes that people have that they don't even know they have. So I always use the example of going with a friend to dinner. He happens to be an actuary at one of these huge investment firms, but he's black. And so what happens? Firstly, they bring the wine list. Who gets the wine list? Me. I'm white. I'm assumed to know about wine. I love wine, but I don't really know anything about it except that it is very nice to drink. One he knew more about it. And then comes the bill. Who gets the bill? I get the bill because I'm white. I'm obviously going to pay it because I'm a rich person. One he's earning 3 or 4 times what I have. Those kind of assumptions, we don't even know we have to, but they are there. Now the difficulty with affirmative action is there a way of capturing that? And is there a way of addressing those inequalities and those kind of systemic ways in which the world is organized without us even knowing it? And how do we do that? There's another layer, of course. Can we do it in a way that is not just going to entrench the very racial assumptions that we try to actually undermine? And that, I think, admittedly, that is a very difficult question to answer. I think there is not an easy answer for that. But, so, I've not really given you an answer. What are we trying to achieve? It seems that if you read between the lines from the Constitutional Court, the court says, well, actually what affirmative action is supposed to do, it's not supposed to give jobs only for people who are politically well connected, for people who are friends of this one or that one, you know, the way the black economic empowerment sometimes work, where shares are given to some people who happen to be members of the governing party. It's kind of bribery, really, because you're bribing the government not to change the economic policy. I think some white people should actually be in favor of that because it keeps everything more or less stable with a little bit of bribery in between.
Okay, that's another story.
So that is not what we want. We want to really get to a place where closer. It's impossible to get to a place where there's truly equal opportunities for all. It's not possible to have equal opportunities for everyone in the society because there are always going to be things are going to be skewed. But we want to address the effects of deep inequality in opportunity in some way. And we want to do it firstly by recognizing that there are certain consequences that make some people less successful, say, at school than others, that has nothing to do with their ability. And secondly, we want to try and address those patterns of discrimination, disadvantage, and harm. We want to try and change really the institutional culture and those kinds so that things are more mixed up and when we have prejudices, when we make assumptions about people, it is challenged and the society becomes more aware of how things are unfair sometimes to some people in invisible ways. So that is, it seems to me, I'm
that I make a little bit up here, because the Constitutional Court hasn't really spoken about this in great detail, but it seems to me that is where the Constitutional Court is trying to go. But there is a very important caveat, and that is when the Constitutional Court, or even the Labour Courts, when they deal with cases, they deal with cases in which the corrective measures are being challenged as unconstitutional. The Constitutional Court or the Labour Court, they do not actually formulate the redress policies. So I would think if the Constitutional Court would formulate the redress policy, it would often look very different from the way in which the redress policy, say, of the Department of Correctional Services or the police, or even a big company would look like. Because they would, the Constitutional Court would be trying a little bit harder, I think, to balance the different interests, as we will see there, that the Constitutional Court does. So one must take that into account. So for the Constitutional Court, it is often, and for the Labour Court, it is often a case of, well, there is now a policy put in place, say, by a government department. Are we going to declare it invalid? Has it gone so far that it is beyond the permissible boundaries of redress measures? And they don't ask, well, is this the best possible policy? Are there other policies that are better suited? You know, these kinds of debates that come in, should we use race as the criteria for redress measures? Should we use race plus other factors like the class and the background of the person? That often happens in the US where law schools, if they still allow, it's a bit unclear at the moment, but they use race, but they use it in a very individualized way. So if you are a black person and you also play the clarinet, or you have gone off to save babies in Malawi or whatever, you get extra points. And if you're a white person and you know you've spent 7 years in the desert trying to bring water to poor people, then you will also get some extra points, that kind of thing. Our system doesn't really work like that because it's very labor intensive, and it is not the courts who decide it. So what I'm talking about is not really the best possible redress measures that could possibly be employed. That is for policymakers, for institutions like the university to try and grapple and come up with. And I don't always think that people get out the best policies, but that is thoroughly about it. Okay. So what did the Constitutional Court say? I think this is the very interesting case of Minister of Finance versus Van Heerden, which I refer to, which is the classical case on this, in which the Constitutional Court tried to give guidance. And the judgment of Justice Mosenege, the Deputy Chief Justice, you mustn't make the mistake like I did once when he came here and I introduced him. First I said I thought he was very sexy, and then I also accidentally called him the Chief Justice just after he was overlooked to become the Chief Justice. But he wrote the judgment, the main judgment. And the starting point of the judgment, he said, we have to understand, remember what I spoke about yesterday, that our constitution embraces substantive equality, not the formal version of equality. That means when we have redress measures, we don't conceptually see them as reverse discrimination, quote unquote. We don't see it as measures that are an exception to the general rule that everybody must be treated the same. Because the very essence of the South African constitutional provision on equality and the essence of the redress provision is that it is not an exception to equality that there must be redress. It is a fundamental requirement for it. So that is a profound difference. In the US, to the extent that the US Supreme Court still allows redress measures,
They say this is an exception to the general principle that you cannot treat people differently based on obnoxious grounds like race, to a lesser extent, gender, and so on. Our courts, and in the US system, what they then say often is that the only reason why you can really have redress is not for equal opportunities or so on, it's actually for diversity. It is freedom of expression is going to suffer if you sit in a classroom or if you're at the office and there are only some voices that are heard and you're not going to mix with everybody in society and say kumbaya. Our system is very different. It's very much based on the past and saying we come from a very specific history, a history that skewed everything. We don't like to sometimes to be reminded of it, and we don't like the fact that it is so, but it is so. It is skewed. It is skewed based on race. It is skewed often based on gender, and it's skewed, and the class issues are often closely mapped on race, not perfectly mapped on race. And so, our court says that it is, therefore, the only way you're going to get to that point where there is slightly more of a chance of people having equal opportunities to succeed in life is if you're going to have redress measures. So it is a requirement for equality to actually be realized. If you treat people exactly the same, they can never be, equality can never be achieved, there can never be even a possibility of equal opportunities for everyone. So that is a profound difference, it seems to me, in the two approaches of our system and of the US system. As a footnote, I just have to say that in terms of international human rights law and in terms of the jurisprudence of foreign courts, the US is a bit of an outlier. They're a little bit 50 years behind the times, if you will. One is not allowed to say that when there are too many US lawyers in the room, but it is, if you look at mainstream legal philosophers, the idea that equality is substantive in nature, that it's, you can't really think about equal opportunities for everyone if you're going to insist that the law treat everybody equally in all situations, are going to be blind to the actual lived reality of people. That seems to make sense. International human rights law, it is accepted. All the UN treaty bodies that has human rights documents that must be interpreted, they all have endorsed the idea in principle of redress measures. Whether those redress measures should be based on class, whether it should be based on geography, whether it should be based on gender, those are the issues that people fight about. But the principle in international actually not very controversial at all. Okay. So I have said that. So I've said that also. Now the question is, how are we going to measure if there's an affirmative action policy? Say the University of Cape Town's admissions policy. Or the policy of the correctional services that says, well, you're a coloured person who used to be classified coloured under apartheid, if you want to get any promotion, you have to go to Limpopo province because there's an oversupply of coloured people here. I'm quoting some famous person. I wonder what happened to him. But in any case, What will happen in such a case if there's those two, say those two examples? What the Constitutional Court said in each of those cases, they are going to first, fundamentally, they're going to say, well, you as the party who is challenging the affirmative action policy, the onus of proof is on you. It's different, I didn't tell you that yesterday, but it's different for ordinary discrimination. If you are discriminated against on the basis of race, sex, gender, ordinarily, and it's not part of an affirmative action policy,
it is assumed, presumed to be unfair. And it's for the state or the party who is discriminating that must come and show that it is not unfair. But if it's a affirmative action policy, the onus shifts around. And if you want to challenge it, so you, Ms. Barnard, who hasn't been promoted now twice in the police force, and nobody, they didn't fill the position with anybody, you have to convince the court that that policy of the police is unconstitutional. So it's more difficult to actually get a court to declare invalid an affirmative action policy than it is for a court to find that there is unfair discrimination in the ordinary course of events where the affirmative action redress policy is not at all involved. But how are you going to prove it? And surprise, as is often the case, I often think that judges, maybe they also all were raised in the Dutch Reformed Church like me, where the German always had 3 points. There's always 3 points. And it's very helpful because when the German come to the third point, you knew you could wake up. So, just like yesterday, there were basically 3 issues that you had to look at to see whether it's fair or unfair. With affirmative action policies, the court said once again, you are going to look at 3 different questions. And you're going to see what each one of them, if they are present, then your policy is constitutionally valid. If they are not present, then the policy is not valid. The first one is you're going to ask, who is this policy targeting? Is this policy targeting and aiming to address the lack of equal opportunities of people who have in the past or continues to suffer unfair discrimination? So we know what does that mean? You can now think. The question could be phrased in a more direct way. You're going to ask, is this policy targeting black people? Is it targeting white women? Is it targeting gay people? Is it targeting people with disabilities? Is it targeting maybe people who are very young or very old, or whatever? Is it targeting people who are HIV positive? So, but there's a problem, of course, and that is a problem of what do you do now, especially as redress policies become more successful. And now what happens, you are going to target a certain group. Because you are making assumptions about that group, you are assuming, for example, that all the members of that group are lacking completely in the kind of opportunities that the other group might have or might have had over time. But as the policies of redress become more successful, what happens? You get people inside the target group who become relatively more privileged than other people in that target group. In India, I find it a very astonishing way of describing it, but in India, where they've had redress measures for 60 years, they call it the problem of the creamy layer. It's coffee at the bottom, but then there's a creamy layer at the top. And the creamy layer are usually the same people who get they benefit again and again from redress. Our court hasn't really grappled with that issue. Maybe because it is, although in newspapers when people debate about this, that it's always mentioned. But I don't think it is such an overwhelming issue yet, especially because of the entrenched prejudices that one still finds about race and so on, and the sort of unacknowledged, invisible assumptions that people make about people of different races. But in any case, it is there. Our court has skirted the problem, actually, by saying we are not going to worry for the moment, we are not going to worry about that. Because we are not going to require that every single person who benefits from this policy can be shown to have still suffering from the consequences of past unfair discrimination. All we're going to ask is that the overwhelming majority
of the people of the group who is targeted is still suffering from the consequences of past or ongoing unfair discrimination. So, what is an overwhelming majority? The court wasn't so very clear in saying what the overwhelming majority is. In the Van Heerden case, who was targeted was people who became members of parliament in 1994. 79% of those people were white, 21% were black, 21% were white, and the court said, well, that policy overwhelmingly targeted black people. So 80% of the people who were targeted, who had not had the benefit, couldn't get to parliament before, couldn't get the pension, they were benefiting. So the 20%, they were just lucky beneficiaries of the system. Okay. So, over time, I think this is going to become a more difficult issue. Over time, as the categories themselves become more fluid, as it becomes, as we break down the assumptions that people have about other people based on their race, as people are less hindered purely because they are happen to be black or women in being advanced at work, as people start realizing that just because you're black, we cannot assume that you're incompetent. Just because you're white, we cannot assume you're competent. If those kind of things start breaking down, it will become more difficult. And those, the court might have to rethink. But at the moment, they have. So we are, that is the first requirement, and we have to stick to it. Okay. Secondly, the court will then ask, what are these measures? Are they designed to protect and advance persons or categories of persons who have been unfairly discriminated in the past or still suffering from the effects of past unfair discrimination? So you have to ask, the court said, what you really have to ask is, you have to ask, will these measures actually have any chance of being successful? The court said you don't have to show that the measures are necessary to actually address the effects of past or ongoing discrimination, but you have to show that they are reasonably capable of doing so. It's a very legalistic way of putting it, but it's the reasonably capable model is really saying, well, you cannot have measures in place. That is a complete thumbs up. That is purely aimed at nepotistic goals. You have to show that there is a reasonable possibility that the measures that you are applying here, that you are applying, say at UCT, that if they are reasonably capable of getting to the goal that you want to achieve, namely that you want to provide a more fair system in which there are more likelihood that people with the same talent will have equal opportunities in life. Okay. It's not a very difficult requirement to meet, I think. Especially in our society where things are still very skewed. And in terms of race, in terms of class, in terms of gender, in terms of many things. So I think it's going to be relatively easy to prove for the court to assume that the measures are reasonably capable of achieving that goal. So usually I don't think the case will stand or fall by that. The third requirement I think is really the one that in most cases will be the one by which a specific affirmative action policy will stand or fall. And the requirement as set out by the court doesn't make any sense on its own, because the court just said, well, the third requirement is you have to ask whether the redress measures are actually promoting equality, the achievement of equality in the long term. Yeah, what the hell does that mean? Doesn't mean anything. I hate it when the students just write that and they don't go on to explain what the court means, because it doesn't mean anything. But the court luckily explained this
a little bit.
And they said, what they mean by this? This is where we actually grapple with the real balancing of different interests. Of course, the court said, we have to admit, when there is redress measures, those measures are not aimed at punishing one group over another. But those measures are necessarily going to disadvantage one group over another, vis-a-vis another. So if you have an admissions policy at UCT that says half the people are admitted based partly on issues taking into account also a person's race, then it makes it more difficult for a white person to get into UCT. That is simple, that is pure logic. So the court said, well, in recognizing that, we have to try and balance the interests of both groups. Trying to interpret our constitution through the lens of the past and recognizing that where we are coming from has put this ugly baby into our hands, so to speak, that we have to deal with. And we have to now make sure that the baby becomes pretty. You might have a metaphor, I'm not sure, but okay. But at the same time, you must also remember there are other human beings involved here, and we have to balance the interests. So Justice Sachs, who wrote a separate opinion in that Van Heerden case, said that we have to think that we have to understand and recognize that redress measures are absolutely necessary for the achievement of equality. But at the same time, if the measures at issue is manifestly overbalanced, I'm quoting now, in ignoring or trampling on the interests of members of the advantaged section of the community, and gratuitously and flagrantly imposes disproportionate burdens on them, the courts will have a duty to interfere. So it's about whether the measures are actually doing what it can do in a way that is least harmful to the group that is actually seen as the previously advantaged group. It's still presently advantaged group, basically. Judge Moseneke explained this further and said that what we really trying to achieve with trying to achieve a society where there's true diversity, where one group's values, assumptions about the world, about other people, is not so dominant that it is going to create all these invisible rules about who has value in our society or not, that is truly going to be a diverse society. But we're going to do that, or we want to do that once again, in a way that is balancing the different interests. And in assessing whether a specific affirmative action policy has struck that balance correctly, the court said, the court must bear in mind that also the effect that the policies will have on the group that is previously advantaged. And now I'm quoting, in particular, a measure should not constitute an abuse of power, which sometimes I think when people complain about affirmative action, it's often because it is actually abuse of power masquerading as redress measures. That is often the most egregious examples that are when I try and argue with people and they say, but this happened, look, and then it's clearly an abuse of power. Of course, you have to go to court to challenge it, but it is not actually legally valid. But in any case, so if it is an abuse of power, or if it imposes such substantial and undue harm on those excluded from the benefit, that the long-term goal of equality of a truly diverse nation, you know, where we all sit around the table and sing Kumbaya, if that is going to be undermined, then the measures would have gone too far. That is the general principle.
Of course, the general principle
is applied in specific cases based on specific legislation. So, in the employment field, there's a specific law, the Employment Equity Act, which has its own rules that places further limits, actually, on redress measures and how far it can go. It's more or less aligned with what the Constitutional Court said here, but it's more explicit. For example, the Employment Equity Act says, when you are imposing redress measures in a workplace, you cannot impose quotas, where you are saying, we are not employing any white people until such time as there are at least 50 or 70 or 80% black people at that level of the workforce. That is not allowed in terms of the Employment Equity Act. You see, that is more or less, it's not explicitly stated like that in the Constitutional Court jurisprudence, but it's very much the same idea that because if you place quotas like that, as happened with Ms. Barnard in the police, that's really what happened, it was a quota. What happened then, there was in effect an absolute bar placed on her promotion because she was white. I would think that, I'm not sure, but I suspect the Constitutional Court is going to say in that particular factual situation that the police employment equity policy went too far because it placed an undue burden on people like Ms. Barnard. Because it made it impossible for her to ever get promoted in the workplace. Which is not the same as saying you cannot have preferences and to say that for this position, this time around, we are rather going to try and appoint people who are black or women or men or whatever. I think that maybe we should appoint more male secretaries here at the university because there are too many female secretaries. The diversity is maybe necessary. But it's not to say that you cannot make that. So people were very cross with Woolworths three years ago, because they advertised certain positions and said, these positions we're going to try and fill just with black candidates. But he didn't say, we are never going to promote any white person ever again. If they did that, they would have been goners. It's not going to be valid in terms of the Employment Equity Act, especially not read through the lens of the Constitution. So there's a delicate balance. Whether the actual employers, whether the state always gets that balance right, I think we can have a very nice and vigorous discussion about that. I don't think that they always get it right. I think sometimes it's a bit too bloody-minded and not the finesse that the Constitutional Court requires of affirmative action to try and deal with both the urgency of transformation and redress on the one hand, but also keeping in mind the effect of those excluded on the other hand, that is sometimes lost in the way it is practically implemented. But that is my view. Let's hear what you have to say. Maybe you have different ideas.
On your key criteria, I can certainly envision a case where the target is clearly identified, where the measures look like they're going to work, that it's reasonably balanced. But it's a pretty shitty policy. There could have been a dozen better policies.
Yes, yeah.
Would the court say this is not adequate?
Yes. You see, that is the point I tried to make earlier. It's the problem of courts. Courts are not good policy makers, and courts are very hesitant to interfere and to say, well, we think the policy you have made is a bad policy. They try and make a distinction because they try to get away what we spoke about on Monday. They are a bit scared of being seen as politicians. They are not elected. So they try to make the distinction. They say, we interfere or intervene when it's unconstitutional. We don't intervene when it's bad or unwise. Because we are not elected. If the government makes a policy that is bad or unwise, well, as Julius Malema said, vote out the bastards. See, I thought I was going to quote you every night tonight. This week, yeah.
So what happens
with
the group that is really being discriminated?
Yes.
What happens if they do something totally bonkers? And I'm thinking of an example from India back when they wanted to bring untouchables into the universities and students who then couldn't get in were setting themselves on fire.
Yes.
Okay, the question is, what happens if the group that is now not being targeted by the affirmative action, but is not the beneficiaries, say in our context, if it's race-based redress measures, if the white group do things that are completely bonkers, like in India, where some of the people who couldn't get places because untouchables were allowed to come into the university, they set themselves alight. No idea. this is an interesting question about what do you do if the law is if there's no legitimacy of the law and people refuse to obey it. It's a bit like the intolerant situation. What would they do in such a situation? You see, the court cannot intervene in such cases, but maybe what they will do, because courts are actually, they are very much aware of the politics. And so when a new case comes to the court will try and justify and try and make an argument for the fairness of the system. But the court itself, of course, are not going to be able to intervene there. That is then the policy makers once again who will have to do that. So although it's a legal issue, it is also very much a policy issue and a governance issue. And one will have to deal with it at that point. I have no idea what will actually happen. It's first to you and then you.
Well, this is from the legal point of view, which is your topic.
Yeah.
Now, what would you say to a young person who is eminently qualified, but finds he or she cannot become a pilot, or a cashier at Woolworths, or a medical doctor because of that person's race? What would you say if it's your child? What would you say if it's going to hundreds of thousands of people that left the country going there?
Well, the hardest thing to say is, of course, look at the statistics and see that for all graduates, when people graduate, it's far easier as a white person to get a job as a graduate than a black person. So after 1 year after graduation, the vast majority of white people have gotten the job, the vast majority of white people, a sizable number of black people haven't. But that's that is the statistical thing. I would say the following, my other answer will be this. I'm speaking now more as a politician. Yes, I would say, you know, we come from this, we have this monkey on our back. And it is one of those things. It's like, you know, what people say to their children in Germany after the Second World War? Something happened that was really bad. And we benefited all from it. The fact that you even went to university has something to do with the fact that you happen to be white. And that we have money to send you there, we have a brilliant education. You know, you could easily have been born in a rural village in the Siki, and you will now be carrying water up and down from the river. So, so that it is not, it is, you know, we have this, and now what are we going to do about it? Because the second point, now I'm really speaking like a politician, but also as a parent. I think if you want to live here, the system of drastic inequality is unsustainable and dangerous. It's in the self-interest of all of us to have a system that begins to address the effects of past injustice. Because if we don't, then what is going to happen? Then you're going to have a system in which, in a far less ordered way, it is going to be, there's going to be a redress of a far more radical kind. So I think it's in the interest of white persons, actually, I'm speaking as a white person, I think it's all of our interest to support these considered moderate forms of redress measures in order to ensure stability in the country. That's all I can say. You know, I might not agree, but I just, yeah.
You know, somebody will just say cause and all that, but you know, the court costs money.
Yes, very much, lots of money.
Something the banks got away with for years, particularly in Johannesburg, but that one here, they wanted to recruit potential bank tellers. Must have a check mat.
Yeah.
And that was sort of, you know, costing stuff. And a heck of a lot of kids who didn't have the trick maths just never bothered to apply to their court. So I don't think we must always acknowledge that everything is bad today and not so bad tomorrow, is there?
Yes. There's a big problem, but you raise another big problem for everybody in our society. That is a larger problem of the things that I talk about often, about the Bill of Rights, the beauty of the rights, the fact that everybody is protected. But in practice, it is sometimes very difficult to have your rights truly protected. Yeah. Because if you want to go to the Constitutional Court, unless you get an NGO to take your case, it's going to cost you 500,000, maybe, a million, if you get the best lawyers, and they charge their full fees. So that is a big problem for all of us, for the implementation of the Bill of Rights in general, I think.
And just take it a notch further. What do you do with the case pending in New Hampshire if a government body ignores the common law court? You had this case with the informed trade.
Yes, yeah.
Where the common court ruled in their favour, and the ignored the order of
There was big cases like this. It doesn't happen often on the national level. But in the Eastern Cape, there was a whole systemic number of cases in which people were ordered to be given access to their social grants. The government just cancelled everybody's social grants and they didn't want to renew some of them sometimes for spurious reasons. And so what the court in that case did, it's systemic. And what the court then did, he made use of what is called the structural interdict, and it's told the government, we order you to do this, and we order you to come back in a month or two to report back what have you done. And then, if they haven't actually implemented the order properly, the order is redone, and they are instructed to take this and this and this extra step and come and report back. That system, of course, works if the tradition is legitimate and there's a political cost involved for the government of the day to actually ignore court orders. And that is why, despite the fact that we spoke yesterday about the JSC and the last few years haven't been particularly good in appointing judges, why in principle I'm a very big supporter of transformation in the judiciary, because if the judges don't look more or less like the society, then it's far easier to just say, we're just going to ignore those bloody bosses who are there to come and tell us what to do.
Isn't there a contempt of court issue there?
There's a contempt of court issue, but the problem, as the Chief Justice Mahomed once pointed out, judges are in a very difficult position because, yes, they have these legal tools, they can even bring somebody in, they can find even the MEC or the minister guilty of contempt of court, the mayor, but judges do not have an army or a police force. They don't actually raise any taxes. They depend on the very government who they now are going to order around to do this for them. And so what judges are actually operating on is their own credibility and legitimacy with the society as a whole. So it's actually a difficult job. Judges are in a very difficult position. And one of the things what we said on Monday, one of the things I think why our courts focus so heavily on the history and the past and trying to justify the interpretation of the Constitution by invoking the past and saying we wanted to get away from it,
is to try and get more legitimacy for the whole constitutional project that they are embarking upon. Because they are in a difficult position, it seems to me. Yes.
Let's put a case to you where all the rules that you have outlined to us have been observed.
Yes.
But there is a law of unintended consequences in that the people that you've now appointed are not competent to do the job, and the public at large is the one that is disadvantaged. How do you deal with that?
Well, you deal with that in the same way that you deal with any person who is incompetent to do the job in terms of the labor law. And now, I've been involved in an NGO, so I know that it's not so easy to actually get rid of somebody who's not capable of doing their job. But you can do it, you just have to follow all the steps, written warning, a second written warning, a disciplinary hearing, and whatever the case might be. So, you can do it that way. But I think you are really asking a different question. And you are asking the question, I will phrase it maybe slightly differently, trying to be politically more correct. And so, there's a trade-off between the way in which redress measures have been implemented, appointed people who don't immediately have all the skills necessary to do the job. So, and then people suffer, like you have in Motlop, where the water purification system is not working because the person that the municipality appointed is not competent. I would say in such a case, what happened there was, it was a perversion of redress. Because somebody, the redress doesn't mean you are allowed to appoint somebody who cannot do the job. At the same time, I'm always a bit nervous when people associate redress with incompetence, because it sounds as if you're saying, well, we're always assuming black people are not competent, which of course is not true. So we have to be careful that there are many, often redress is nothing more than appointing the most competent person and forcing the all-white jury to recognize that the person happens to be the black person. Because we have a tendency always to select, of course, those who look like us, who behave like us, who... I've sat in appointments committees. You know, the person that I immediately think I like that one is the person who has my interests, who came at my, maybe from the same background, who can't speak in, whatever. And redress measures are aimed at breaking those kind of assumptions down. When it works well, that is what it does. When it doesn't work well, people are appointed who shouldn't be appointed, and then it's a travesty of the firm, seems to me.
I'm not in your environment alone.
Yes.
But I'm functioning down at the hospital.
Mm.
And I've been re-employed to implement something while. And I'm dealing with a whole lot of incompetent people.
Mm.
Now, I'm not in a position to evaluate their competence on a professional way, but I can evaluate their competence in terms of my own background, in terms of are they reliable, are they responsible, are they honest. And I find that much of that it's almost endemic within our civil service, the provincial government, that there are significant problems. And I never hear the question of incompetence brought up as a reason for a failure of delivery.
Yes.
Delivery process, to me, is civil disobedience. And it's a civil disobedience based on the fact that the appointments have been lousy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
No,
I agree with you.
I'd like to make a further point, and that is that those appointments have been made at the cost of disposing of the experienced people who could do the training and build these people up. And that is something which in the next 10 to 15 years we are going to suffer like you can't believe it.
So, once again, I started off by making distinction between policies
And the last question up there.
Policy.
Okay. And how they are implemented and the principles. So I spoke mostly about the principles. I don't work in the civil service. So, you know, I'm not a change agent or whatever they call those people who go in there and say, why is things not working? So I don't have enough information to know what the story is there, so I can't really comment on it. Yeah.
This is a general question on court procedure. We're all aware of how slow and inefficient the courts are and how things get held up and lost and postponed. Yeah. Is there anything in the Constitution that can be used to assist that?
You know, people, in terms of the Constitution, have the right of access to court and to have any dispute that is capable of being resolved through law, to have it resolved through a legal process. There's not a specific provision in the Constitution that requires speedy resolution of such cases. In the criminal law, there's a principle that is not actually written into the Constitution that it must be within, you know, there must be a court case and a criminal trial within a reasonable time. This, once again, I think this is management. It is bad management. And it's bad management in the sense of the different courts. They had to all be brought into one system, and it wasn't done. The left hand doesn't always know what the right hand is doing, and the people who were there before and the people who are there now don't always have the wherewithal to make the system streamlined. So I don't think it's going to change soon. Interestingly enough, the Chief Justice is not very eager to actually sit in court cases and hear cases, but he's very eager to improve the legal system. And he is doing a lot of stuff behind the scenes to try and make the courts more efficient. So he's actually, it's a success story in that sense. He might have other issues, but as a manager of the court system, he's actually holding people to account. There's now been 3 or 4 judges who have been taken to the Judicial Service Commission because they have outstanding judgments of 3 or 4 years. It would never have happened before because people would be too scared to hold these people accountable for not actually doing their job. So that is, in a way, maybe over time, if there's enough of that stuff, it will actually begin to change the system. Now, one last question, then I have to go to Bruce Christie.
Two brief points. Yes. One is, if you have lived in a country other than South Africa for any period of time, you will be aware that local authorities and municipalities are full to the brim with incompetent people in every shape, colour, size, and they are bloody useless and it drives you mad.
Yes.
Secondly, and perhaps more controversially, if this was a room full of people 30 years ago who were black, and what they might have to say about whether or not services were delivered to them by competent people. I think it's time just exercised a little bit of imagination.
Okay, on that high note, we're going to end the session. Thank you very much for coming. And we will listen.